This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time. The First Time podcast has a newsletter. It will go out monthly-ish. To sign up, go to our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com, and click on the Sign Up to Our Newsletter link. Hi!
Hello, Catherine.
Hi, Kate.
How are you going?
Yeah, I'm good.
That's good.
How are you going?
I'm good. See, you asked that in such
a loaded
way.
Do you want to talk about it?
No, I don't want to talk about it. I've decided, dear listeners, you know how this second season is all about us talking about our second books? But we're just not talking about them for a little bit. Maybe this is how you...
I feel okay about mine. I think it's mainly...
Yeah, it's mainly me. It's mainly me.
Weighty Mildenhall over there.
Waiting Mildenhall. So who knows? Maybe I'm not waiting anymore once this is released into your ears, but you'll never know because we're not going to talk about it anymore. We're going to talk about something entirely different today.
What are we talking about?
We're going to talk about professional learning.
It's a good one.
Well, you know, if I was still in my lovely cushy public service job, people pay me to go and do my professional learning.
They pay a lot too. Yeah.
Do you have to do it? Do you have like
engineering? We do have a lot of codes, courses, and
different
sorts of things like that. It's actually very good.
I love it.
It's very enjoyable.
It's always enjoyable to learn. Look at my face, lit up like a Christmas tree. But we want to talk about what writers do for professional learning because there's that old, you know, age-old debate about you can't learn to write, which we figure we've debunked that already, right? Everyone knows you can learn to write. What kind of professional learning have you done in the writing world, Catherine?
I'm going to let you talk about RMIT.
Oh, thanks so much.
So I'll put that in your basket.
Right.
I'm going to talk about something I did pretty recently, which is Anthony Yark's masterclass. Have we talked about this before?
I don't think we have. I mean, you and I have talked about it at length, but not on the podcast.
So Anthony Yark, he's almost like a whisperer you hear about. Like you hear the name.
You totally hear the name.
So apparently, the legend goes that Anthony Yark was responsible for setting up the RMIT professional writing and editing course.
Mm-hmm.
But this mysterious figure eventually left RMIT and now he runs his own masterclasses. They're not advertised.
They're not.
You hear about them. You knock on a door at midnight.
Yeah.
You say the red password. No, you just, the way that I found out about it, I think it came from two directions at once. Maybe I heard someone or read someone mention something on Facebook. And then at the same time, someone in our writers group sent a pamphlet around. I don't think she had done it at that stage. She was about to. I probably heard about the masterclass 6 or 9 months ago. I wanted, of course, immediately to enroll, but it was booked up. He probably runs them every 2 or 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 5-day masterclass. There's about a dozen people in the class and most of them will have been published, have books. And it involves, I suppose there's two parts to each day. You sort of have one part that is more teaching based and then you do a lot of workshopping.
It was fabulous. So what did you go in hoping to get out of it?
So I had my second manuscript. I had a lot of questions about it. I wasn't sure about a few things. I hadn't shown it to anyone. I wanted feedback on whether things were working. I didn't want detailed feedback on... I just wanted that first read where someone goes, yeah, it's good, keep going.
Yeah.
Or I don't really get this person. I didn't, you know, wasn't really interested in on the line and I absolutely got it. It was really, really useful at that. I kind of wondered if it would be too late in the process, but it was very, very helpful. It was very affirming.
That's great.
Yeah.
Because you're right. It does have to be at the right time. Because sometimes you can do... You know, or either the same people can do the same course or the same kind of
I think class. You have to be quite progressed. I think it's hard to do, say if you're doing an analysis of your plot, if you're trying to invent a plot at the same time that you're analysing a plot, it's just can be disheartening.
Yeah. And you can get, I remember doing the Refine Your Novel course at Writers Vic with the fabulous Tony Jordan. And I
that is the other one I would say is phenomenal. Tony
phenomenally
Jordan's
good. And I would like to do it again at different stages because I did it too early, but it was hugely useful for the project that I did. But then I've gone back and looked at my notes to see what she asked at different times and done it again, on the
like
same manuscript. Yeah, kind of like
process.
Self. Obviously, it's not as good, but.
Yeah, these two, Anthony's masterclass and Tony Jordan's masterclass, are the two things I would say are both phenomenal.
And it's kind of like therapy in that way that it's not like you're learning content. You're not kind of learning how to write. Some of it is that, but you're also being asked questions that are stimulating you to do your
own
work.
And it's hearing other people's
thing.
As well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And not only workshopping other people's, but, workshopping other people's and hearing the analysis, you know, what comes back. The only thing that I would, you know, it's a minor comment, and I say this partly because we've just had a discussion about workshopping, is I often feel that, or it's a common experience in that group workshopping scenario, that someone's work will be pulled apart in a way that is completely disproportionate to the standard of the work.
Yep.
So it's generally not the worst work in the class by any stretch.
No,
I think
people
let
don't,
that slide.
Yeah, because people don't do it to those people.
It's often one that people actually like, but it just gets completely pulled apart. I wasn't that person this time.
Yeah. I think that is what's really hard about workshopping and that you need to the kind of skin that you grow around your workshopping too.
That was actually one really, really great thing was that when we were workshopping, I found myself really able to say disagree, like in my head, to engage and listen to everything that people were saying, but to be very clear on, I disagree with that comment. That is very useful to me. This is interesting. And that's
great.
Know, yeah, it was great.
So do you think
it felt like an evolution?
So that feels different to when you were in classes at RMIT, for instance?
Yes. In previous, say 2 years ago, if someone had in a workshopping scenario said something, I would have felt I needed to address that in my manuscript.
Do you
but
feel,
now
like
feel like
that's I've... just having a big yellow I'm published sticker on your chest?
No, not at all. I think I have evolved as a writer in the sense that I have a stronger vision for the book and a more of a willingness to please myself.
That's good.
Maybe. Not completely.
Yeah.
Which does not by any stretch say I'm not open to feedback.
Of course.
But that if someone says, I think you should do this.
Yeah.
I'm okay to say no.
Yeah, nice.
Previously.
Good.
And you, formal learning?
So, you know, as we have talked about at length and what you and I have both done, my biggest formal learning has been professional writing and editing at RMIT, which I am yet to finish, as
so
are you. But, you know, that's just the most extraordinary course. It's about content. It's about networking. It's about being made to set goals for yourself and then to reach them, I suppose, to validate yourself as a writer and to say, to own, that's what I'm going to do. So I think, you know, it's changed my life.
Yeah, I would agree.
Completely.
It's changed your life.
No, yes,
it has.
It's changed both. And it's obviously where we met, the birthplace of this podcast. But I also think that I do better with a whole lot of inputs coming in. So RMIT for a number of years has been that input. When I'm not doing classes and I'm not at the moment, I have to get my inputs from other places. So I seek out masterclasses. So I do something like the Tony Jordan one. I've recently done a great one with Writers Vic, which was with James Bradley, who we interviewed, and Jane Rawson on writing.
So
Vic.
Great.
It's fantastic. And it's that thing of the people you meet having very knowledgeable teachers who are talking about process, all the things that you think about, the book list that you go away with.
Yeah. Like, I'm just shopping for one at the moment. I want one on screenwriting to write a play.
Oh, excellent.
Which I've been fishing around for, but I just haven't found quite what I'm looking
People
for.
People, get in contact if you know which course Catherine should do. And I think wherever you are in Australia, if you're in Australia, our growing international 10% audience,
if you are not,
that your writer centre, your state writer centre, will have fabulous
writing courses. Yes, the writers are amazing.
We have some coming up.
Look at that. What a segue.
Oh, what a segue. can we talk about them yet?
Yeah, totally.
Right. Second half of the year, we will be in both Canberra and in Sydney running some workshops on how to make a podcast.
Yep. We won't be calling it that, though.
No.
It sounds too familiar.
Oh, really?
Sounds a bit like how to be a writer.
Tell me, though, online courses, what about those? Done any?
Recommend any? I haven't done a formal online course. I have wanted to enroll in, I think, Stephen Amsterdam and also Laurie Steed do those short story feedback ones. I think that's a phenomenal concept.
And they talk about them all the time on Twitter. You see just this little gang of short story aficionados.
I'm desperate to do that, but I just need to finish I'm a one thing at a time.
Yeah.
I can't do multiple things at once. I did have a short story once that I emailed an editor about. She's a pretty freelance editor, pretty high profile. I ended up getting it through another channel. But do you know how much this one editor was going to charge for a 1,500 word, 2,000 word short story?
Tell me.
Have a guess.
No, I can't even.
$800.
$800.
Do you think that's extraordinary?
Extraordinarily high.
Yeah.
No, probably not.
Really? Now.
Yes. Maybe.
But a manuscript assessment, you might only pay $1,500. That's like 70,000 words.
Good point. But then once you're into it, you just keep reading it. I don't know. Now that I'm a
2,000 words
writer with
take
no
you
other
10
work.
Minutes to read. Mm.
Was it a may I ask? Was it a man?
No, it wasn't. So kudos to her.
I was going to say, but... yeah. Kudos to anyone who's
charging $800. So what's that a word? It's
amount.
It's quite a lot.
I think we were talking then momentarily about Twitter, and I would count Twitter as part of my professional learning.
Mm.
Book recommendations.
Yep.
Stuff to look at. Getting a sense of arguments about whole things, about representation or diversity in publishing. Getting across. Okay, I'm going to follow these people and I'm going to see what they say. And I think what was really cool about that, doing that masterclass with James and Jane, was that I realized a whole lot of the texts were things that I knew that they were referring to, were things that I knew because they'd tweeted about them before and then I'd read those articles, you know? So I felt I kind of know the body of work that I need to be engaging with if I'm going to write in this particular area.
Yeah.
So I think that
makes
stuff
a lot of sense.
Is really cool. Although we all know the pitfalls of Twitter. I also have done things gone and sat in on lectures in different areas.
Really?
Yeah, the geology lectures I've been sitting in on. So that kind of professional learning in specific content, specific areas that you need to, what you're doing when you go to the US.
Yeah, God, I'm so excited.
I'm so excited that you're doing that too. What else? What other things?
Podcasts. Do you know this one podcast? I will have mentioned it to you. It's called Good One. And it's, the tagline is it's about jokes, basically. So each episode, the way that it works is you will have, say, 10 or 15 minutes and it will be a comedian, stand-up comedy, a comedian routine. So you listen to that. And then there's, say, a 40-minute interview with that comedian. And it is dissecting at the level of word. So the host will say, okay, so in this one you said, I don't know, how about those Red Sox? But I noticed that that's how you put it in 2016. But I noticed that in 2017, when you performed the same joke, you said, how about those Red Sox? Aren't they amazing? And so they'll even go into this whole depthful analysis of the benefits and the it's just absolutely fascinating.
So are you doing that? Are you listening to that? And one side of your brain is going, how am I going to use this knowledge? What am I learning about writing? What am I learning about delivery? Is that
the way you learn so much? It's just interesting to see how, I guess, how jokes are created. People talk a lot about their process and those sorts of things. But even just to get that, and it's purely in the context of humor, but I don't know, just even talking about the certain emphasis that, and this is in a performative space, but the yeah. emphasis that you give to certain words and how people have matured and how the way that they not so much approach it, but the level of sophistication in a joke. Like there's a cheap, not a cheap joke, but a joke that's often critiqued in comedy, which is, it's called the callback. So at the start you'll say, oh yeah, you might get a bit of a laugh for saying you slipped on a banana peel. And then later on, half an hour later, I'll mention Kate and say, but watch out for the bananas. So it's sort of an unsophisticated way of getting a joke, but an audience really, really loves it. Yeah. And so there's sort of things like that that you're like, that's, yeah, it's just interesting.
I like this.
It's a very interesting discussion. So there's some great ones. Rhea Butcher's haircuts and flight attendants is phenomenal. Like it is just it's a very gendered, it's often comedy that has a layer of social analysis sitting within it. And so you start getting into that social analysis space.
This is a particular area of delight. Yeah.
And they're phenomenal. The interview is phenomenal. It's just great. So, okay. Good one.
So get your podcast library listening list updated with some of Catherine's recommendations. Reading obviously always counts.
Yep.
For our accountants, also it counts when you are a writer. The books that you buy and the museums you go to and the films you go to. I recently went on a lovely writing excursion with one of my writing gangs and we went to Tarawarra and it was great. It was great. It was like an input. It was getting out of our normal catch-ups, getting out into the actual world and having something to put into the tank, so to speak. So I think doing those kinds of activities – I'm a junkie for how to write kind of books as well.
Yeah. I like the podcast form. I'm reading more how to write books. I can't read a how to write book front to back.
No. You have to be able to dig into them. There's actually a really good thread at the moment. Search back. It won't be at the moment anymore. I think Gabrielle Tozer was asking for writing books recommendations on Twitter. So you can go back and search Twitter.
We can link to that,
I think. And I wanted to mention to building community, your writing community, through all of that other stuff, going to writers' festivals, going to launches, going to bookshops, reading the stuff, the book pages in the newspaper. I kind of count that as knowing my industry. Is that right?
Yeah, it's true. And that's sometimes – I always just feel the juggling act of that, the impact on family. I wish they would hold them – more stuff during the day
when all the writers
in the morning
they
like everything
could do
is
that.
Yeah,
when all the writers
that would be much would just work a lot
writing.
Better for me.
Yeah, but all of these things count, and I think sometimes what we have to recognize too is it's not a hobby. We're writers.
That's true.
And you know, and that idea of the professionalization of it, going, yeah, I can invest in a course or invest in doing this thing because I'm a writer and this is what everyone else in all their other professions gets to do as well, and spend time reading and spend time, you know.
Because we're writers, so it's important.
I
just want an office.
Yeah.
That's what I would love. But anyway.
An office too. That would be useful as well. Okay. Let us know what you do to professionally learn and any recommendations for courses, books, podcasts that we should listen to as well. And we shall share them with everyone in the newsletter.
The next one comes out soon.
If you haven't signed up yet, do sign up. It's an experiment of sorts, as all things that we do are. It's full of great links and it can arrive in your inbox. Sign up on the website.
In this interview, we talk to Rajith Savanadasa about writing novels, documentary theatre, and the advice he'd give his debut self. Rajith Savanadasa was born in Colombo, Sri Lanka, and now lives in Melbourne. He was named a Best Young Australian Novelist by the Sydney Morning Herald in 2017 for his debut novel Ruins, which was also shortlisted for the Australian Literary Society Gold Medal and the Readings Prize for New Australian Fiction. In 2018, Rajith was an artist in residence at the Malthouse Theatre in Melbourne. Welcome, Raj.
Thank you. Now, I finally made it.
You did. We've had a bit of trouble with getting into the studio today. let's get into it. So your book, Ruins, came out at the same time as Kate Mildenhall's in 2016.
Yep.
And I can remember attending, and you may remember as well, maybe not my specific presence, but a Next Big Thing event at the Wheeler Centre. Do you remember that?
I do remember the event, yeah. I think there was Michelle Wright and Jane Harper.
Was it Jane Harper?
I think Jane
as
Harper
well?
Was on that group, on that list as well. Yeah.
Kate's nodding. That's an impressive cohort.
Yeah.
A very impressive cohort. So I've been aware of your writing for a very long time, but I only just read Ruins. And so a very big belated congratulations. It
Thanks.
Is a fabulous book.
It takes time to get to a book sometimes.
It does. It does.
It has to come to you.
Exactly. So before we get into how Ruins came to be, let's go back in time a little bit. Did you write as a kid?
Well, not really. I didn't do creative writing as a kid. I mean, I'm from a culture where the creative arts isn't really seen as more than a hobby, a little pastime. You know, it's not considered something that you do, that you commit a lot of time to or put in any serious effort doing.
Right. So what did you, were you into sports or were you into?
Yeah, I was into sports. My parents really pushed me towards academia and sport. So I played quite a lot of sport and I wasn't particularly great at studies. I just didn't have the attention span. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, you know, pretty typical Sri Lankan sort of upbringing where you're pushed to be a doctor or an engineer or a lawyer and, you know, pushed to play tennis and cricket and whatever.
That's probably a pretty good segue. Yeah. You studied engineering.
I did
at
study
uni.
Engineering, yes.
Now, I understand why a person would do that, but was it a parental push that interests you in that, or you were interested anyway? Or
partly a parental push. So there was also just the feeling that these are the options that are available to me. So there was, you know, these three things I could do: become a doctor, or be study, you know, biology, or study medicine versus studying engineering or something else. And, you know, one of the reasons was that I could actually listen to music while doing maths. So I just went, all right, I'll, you know, go down the mathematics stream so that I can kind of have some fun while I'm doing it.
And so you continued doing engineering for a couple of years at uni and then hit your final year.
Yeah, 4 years. Yeah.
What happened?
I just got a bit tired of it and I felt like, you know, this wasn't really me. I mean, I just found that it had no passion for engineering. I just went through the motions and I was good enough to get my degree. It's good enough to do fairly well, but at the same time, it wasn't really something I was passionate about. I didn't care about it.
And so did you then start doing creative writing subjects at the same time or did you?
Yeah. So in the final year, we could do a couple of electives. So I did creative writing and I did philosophy and those were like the world just kind of opened up to me. Yeah.
And so from there, did you go straight into studying creative writing or did you?
I took a little while deciding. I started working, so I worked for a big consulting firm. Also didn't really have much fun doing that. And then I decided I would try. I started professional writing and editing right here at RMIT.
And was that how you started writing Ruins? Did you start, because there's a novel writing course as
well. There is novel. Novel is part of it. And yeah, I did classes with Tony Jordan and I did start a novel and I think Tony's still a bit disappointed that I didn't continue writing that particular novel.
What was that about?
I mean, it was similar stuff. It was, there was a story about a domestic worker and a young man, sort of their relationship, but I kind of somehow got sidelined. I probably read a bit too much David Foster Wallace and started trying to do like, crazy postmodern stuff.
Right.
And then, I had a bit of a, like, I mean, every novel kind of brings an existential crisis, I think. So I had that, went away, did an oral history project, came back to what I thought was a short story. And I wrote like that first chapter of Ruins and that's where it started. And it actually just went from there. I just wrote, you know, 14 chapters. In sequence.
And how long did that take?
Took about 12 months or 13 months.
Wow, that's quite quick.
Yeah, it was quick. But I do think all that other work I did previously prepared me for it. So I'd actually written a draft of a novel, which just wasn't working, felt really forced. And
so this is essentially the third manuscript you had
Well, that first one I did at class, I only wrote about two or three chapters. It must have been 10,000 words at most.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so in this time, you had a hot desk fellowship, didn't you, at the Wheelers Centre?
Yeah, 2014, I think.
Was that when you were writing Ruins?
Yes. I would have written, I don't know, three or four. I probably wrote the middle chapters at the hot desk. Yeah, so right in the thick of it.
Can you talk a little bit about what the hot desk fellowship involves?
You get a desk up at the Wheeler Centre.
Oh, it's thing. Very well named.
accurate. But also you get a bit of money, which is, you know, nothing to sneeze at.
Because they're very hard to get, really.
They're hard to get. Yeah,
a lot of people apply.
But I think the best thing about it for me was the fact that, especially for me, it was finally feeling legitimized. You know, I hadn't written too many short stories. I hadn't had anything published in journals or anything like that. And that was sort of the first big win for me. Mm. And so after I'd, you know, written three chapters and was starting to get positive feedback, that felt like, oh, you know.
It's happening.
Yeah, it's happening. Just keep going. And that started some momentum.
So from a practical point of view, because the hot desk, the fellowship that goes for, is it 8 or 10 weeks, something like that. And did you go every day then?
Is that not really. I was still working. So throughout, I've still been working in the telecoms industry. So I think I was working maybe part-time, maybe 3 days a week. So I probably spent 1 or 2 days at the Wheeler Center. I remember going in at after work, doing a couple of late nights there. And yeah, I mean, I just felt like I needed to make use of the opportunity.
And did you meet other writers?
Yeah, that was a really good part of it as well. I'm competitive by nature, and so there was Jennifer Down sitting, you know,
right
on the end, and she was churning out, you know, she was winning all these awards and churning out short stories, and so I was like, oh yeah, better get this going. and you know, there wasn't just writers; there were people who were working on like poetry and. Not just novelists, but people who did poetry and graphic novels and all these different practices. So it was nice to, you know, sit with them and have a good chat about process and how things are different in each of their worlds.
And so you also, Ruins was, I guess, an outcome of the Hachette Queensland Writer Centre Manuscript Development Program. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So did you apply for that program once the manuscript was finished?
It was almost finished. So I would have been well past the halfway stage, probably, you know, two chapters away from finishing. And I remember, so I think we had to submit three chapters at the start and then submit the whole manuscript if you made the shortlist.
So how... Oh, okay. So you are shortlisted for selection?
Yes.
And then you submit the whole manuscript.
And then you submit the whole manuscript. And it was at that point I remember rushing to the finish line and just finishing it off before sending it in.
And so we're obviously based in Melbourne. Do you then fly to Queensland?
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
And so is that like a week long?
It was less than that, I think, if I remember correctly, 3 or 4 days.
Did that have a very big impact on...
Yes, it did, because each person's paired up with someone from Hachette, usually an editor or a publisher, and that person's obviously read your manuscript and has very particular feedback for you. So it's like a second shot at, you know, an early shot at trying to impress your publisher or get feedback that would, you know, get it to a stage where they think it's publishable.
And so what was the feedback like?
So I met my editor, Kate, at... in Queensland. And so it turned out to be quite a big change that she suggested. I'd written the novel. So the novel's got five first person narrators, and the order in which I'd written it was, you know, the servant, the daughter, the father, the son, and the mother. And then with my first draft, I'd written the second half in reverse order.
Oh, right.
So
was there a reason for that? That you had made that decision?
I can't quite remember. That's just how it turned out, I think. And then Kate suggested that. So essentially the son came right after the middle chapter in that first draft.
Yep.
And then Kate suggested that he's the person who seems to change the most in the story and it feels a bit quick. And she was like, could you just swap the chapters around? And I was like, no, that's essentially a rewrite of the second half. But that's what I went and did. And I think it was better for it.
So on the back of that, you go away.
You'd go away. So nobody gets a contract out of that. but then you go away and then you resubmit
at any time.
We were encouraged to take our time and not be too hasty with it. So I took a good 5 or 6 months, I think.
Yeah.
Rewriting and then rejigging.
You sent straight to Kate.
Yeah, straight to Kate. Yeah, and then even then it's so Hachette has quite a long process of all the editors have to agree on it. So there's an editorial meeting and then they agree on whether it's worthwhile. Then I think it gets taken to another meeting. They crunch numbers, acquisitions, something like that. There's like 2 or 3 meetings that it gets taken to and everyone has to be on board basically.
And so do you remember, did you get the phone call? Was it an email?
I got a phone call. It was actually a very difficult time because I'd written... So the main character, one of the main characters in the book is Lathai is a servant who's based on, and this is the only person who's actually based on a real character. Everyone else is pretty much a composite. Lathai is based on Yasa, who's my parents', their servant essentially.
And who the book is dedicated to.
Yeah, the book is dedicated to her. And she was going through some really bad health problems. So I'd gone back to Sri Lanka to see her. She'd been through some operations. And then it was as I came back that I got the call. So I was like really, I was kind of dealing with a bit of grief at the time. And I almost felt like I'd exposed her to the world and now this, the world was sort of going to take her away from me or something like that. So yeah, it was a funny time.
Wow, that's a real merging of real life and fiction, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is interesting in light of some of the theatre stuff.
Yeah, yes.
We will talk about shortly.
Yeah.
So Ruins was published, obviously, in Australia by Hachette. Mm. It was also published by Hachette India. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So did Hachette here negotiate that?
That's right, yeah.
Process. And so did that mean it was translated?
No, it was still in English. My understanding is that not much happened apart from changing a few quotes on the cover.
Right. Yeah. So did it then come out in Sri Lanka through that Indian...
Yes, it's essentially they sold the rights to the subcontinent. So that's India, Sri Lanka, and I think Pakistan and Bangladesh or something like that. But I did find it quite disappointing that when I went to a bookstore in Sri Lanka, I couldn't really find it. I feel like now that I know a bit more about what happens in the publishing world, I think in India or in other countries like the UK, it's more... agents that do the pushing into and maybe that's the difference. I just couldn't find it in Sri Lanka and I took it upon myself at one point too.
Yeah.
I emailed a few bookstores and they were like, why didn't you tell us? And so they got a few books in.
Did you then go to bookstores or
I did, like, yeah. Then I had some bookstore events and it was a bit easier once I'd got in touch and did that myself. But I'm a lazy writer. I don't feel like I need to do any of the marketing.
Wow. That's the thing, though. Most writers like writing.
Yeah, exactly.
There are very few that enjoy marketing.
Yeah.
Thinking back to when Ruins came out, what was the best bit?
When it came out, it almost felt anticlimactic, like it comes out and you're kind of like, I'm always reminded of that scene in BoJack Horseman. I don't know if you've watched that show.
No.
It's this funny show about it's a cartoon about a depressed... a washed-up actor who happens to be a horse. And he has this moment when he gets nominated for an Oscar. And then he's sort of like, there's all this build-up. There's a moment where he's like, I feel the same. And I feel like, going on that novel writing journey, you feel like there's going to be this transformation at the end of it that you're going to become something. And it doesn't really happen. Mm. You're still the same. You still got to deal with everything that the petty little grievances that you have. That happened. But the best bit was probably getting feedback and good, really nice feedback.
From readers,
from critics was good. But also, I got some really lovely emails. Like, there was one from a man in, there was one from a hotel owner in Negumbo. So this is a place in Sri Lanka. And people had started leaving copies of Ruins there. And he was saying, I just opened it up and I just got into it. And he was Swiss, so there was this kind of endearing. I could almost hear his voice in the email. And he said, oh, you know, by the time I looked up, I'd gone through a whole chapter. And then there was a story, like a little sub story about how one of his workers who doesn't really speak very good English, but he was trying to get to read, picking the book up and wanting to read it. And now I'm calling him employee of the year, something like that. And so that was probably, yeah, it was a really lovely moment.
Now you are also working on your second book. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
In a roundabout way, by the sounds of things.
Yeah.
You're also working on a play, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah.
That sounds like that might be taking up a little bit more of your time.
I think a lot of my focus has gone to the play lately. And I mean, I feel like the play and the novel that I've been working on have sort of worked in parallel, but also one feels like the flip side of the other in a sense, because I'm working with fiction and the play is essentially nonfiction. So it's a documentary play, but I'm also, I'm looking at that intersection of reality and fiction.
Which is
fiction.
Pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
How did the play come about? How did the...
I basically got an email from someone at the Malad House who suggested I apply for a... So they had a program called Living Now, which is for...
The Malad House is a theatre in Melbourne, isn't
it? That's right, yeah. They had a program for culturally and linguistically diverse writers and, you know, went through the application process, got in, and I spent about 6 months just watching theatre being made and kind of having lots of time with dramaturgs and directors and having lots of conversations, which is, yeah.
So really that's what an artist in residence, that's what the program was about, that you would sort of sit in on the process of creating plays.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you're also just given the space, you know, we were given a desk and given like, so Mark Pritchard was the dramaturg that I worked with and he kept giving me, you know, all these books about documentary theatre because that's what I pitched. I wanted to do documentary theatre.
So describe what documentary theatre actually is.
It's like a documentary film. You know, it's essentially talking heads. So it's interview-based. So you'd talk about a particular event or a person's life and you'd tell the story through interviews. So it's essentially something that's in their words. But I guess the difference between film and theatre is that it's an actor who's using someone else's words.
And so is there any choreography in something like that or it's literally just like a spoken monologue?
It's usually just, I mean, I was actually hoping to make verbatim theatre, which is even a bit closer to, so it's recordings and actors sometimes wear headphones and speak what they hear. So there's more of an immediacy to it.
And would they necessarily have heard what they're hearing before or would it?
Yeah, they would have. Yeah, usually. I mean, they would come in with a bit of practice, I think.
Wow.
But I feel like, yeah, that would bring a bit more to the performance. But I didn't end up being able to do that partly because this person that I was interviewing, there were a bunch of obstacles in telling the story.
So whose story is it?
I can't tell you. we're actually still working out the parameters of what we can and can't tell.
Yep. Now, we have spoken a little bit about second books. Mm. That's the theme for this season.
Oh, no.
You are in the thick of it.
Yeah.
Have you got any advice for our listeners?
I can give you the advice that I would give myself, which is I think I always get into I have ideas, so that's where I start writing. And I have these themes that I want to address or these particular, they'd either be like a philosophical idea or some other political idea that I want to explore. And I often use that as a starting point. And even though I know it's not good for me, I kind of go down that path and I end up writing. Like I wrote a whole draft essentially trying to explore a certain thing. And then I ended up finding that it felt a bit contrived or all the pieces didn't quite fit together and it didn't feel organic.
So you are a pantser.
I'm a pantser. Then. I'm definitely a pantser. I don't think I could ever be a plotter because part of the joy of it for me is to discover something as you go along, just to discover myself really. I don't think I could.
So for the novels or the stories and things that don't work, do you take that theme with you into the next attempt?
What I find is then after I've done that draft, and this happened with Ruins as well, so with that previous draft, I'd written a whole draft, and then I realized this wasn't working, and I'd almost given up the idea of writing a novel. So I find I have to push it aside, put all those thoughts away, and then focus on character, and then find the character to tell the story, and let the character lead the way. But then I also find that those things I've been obsessing over do come into it, but they come into it in unexpected ways.
Fantastic. That's it. Thanks, Raj, for being on the show.
Thank you.
This is the first time Quick Five with Rajith Savanadasa. Now, you're allowed to pass on any question.
Okay.
So for your first time.
Pass.
It's like when people say, can I ask you a question? You're like, you've already used it.
Yeah, I know.
So for your first time, agented or unagented?
Unagented.
Advance or no advance?
Advance. What does that mean? As in, did I get an advance?
Yeah, did you get an advance?
Yeah, I did.
Overseas territories or just Australia, New Zealand?
Overseas.
Festival invites or no festival invites?
Yeah, festival invites.
Copies sold?
Like a number. I think I sold a bit over 3,000, something like that. Yeah.
And finally, what's your favourite novel by a debut author?
I can't think of a favourite, but I recently read Asymmetry by Lisa Halliday, which is really good. Yeah.
A recommendation. Mm. To find out more about Rajith or to check out our show notes, go to thefirsttimepodcast.com or get in touch via Twitter or Instagram at thefirsttimepod. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe 80. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.